Welcome to Top 5, a show where we count things down from number 5 all the way to number 1. And I'm gonna slow it down here. We're going to get a little deep and a little serious. I know sometimes we sit here on Top 5 and we talk about things that are a lark. You know, sending someone circus peanuts for their birthday or holiday. Or if they, if you ever see them live, you can just flick them at these people.
Lark, of course, in Steven we world can, means cruel. Cruel we can, tapes.
I mean, I would never do those things. That's part of the fun and the humor, right? And we talk about things that are like light and happy and joyous a lot of times. But then we get Jimmy. And Jimmy is, hey, guys, how about you do a top 5 comics that made you cry? And so this week, we're going to tear up a little bit. We're going to get a little bit more serious. We're going to talk about comics that made you cry. Just Matthew and I here this week because we're comfortable with our feelings. We can admit that we cry. We're men that cry. Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And so I'm also okay to admit that there are some times when I think Damian Wayne isn't horrible.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Batman and Robin number 18. The death of Damian Wayne, probably one of the greatest moments in Damian Wayne's life. But anytime a character dies, which tends to be as I'm looking at everything on my list, death seems to be pretty predominant in this. And I hate to see somebody die because, you know, the feelings and the grief that you go through, or in the case, if you're Bruce Wayne, having your clone baby son or whatever he was, taken away from you just as you're 18 issues into knowing about him is tragic. And I will admit that a little tear may have left my eye and traveled partway down my cheek when Damian Wayne died in the pages of Batman and Robin number 18, part of the new 52, if I'm not mistaken. So there, Matthew, there. I will admit that I can shed a tear for Damian Wayne. What say you? What is your number 5?
Don't shed a tear for Damian Wayne. I feel like, you know, we are generally kind of japes and jesters, but I feel like it's also good to be able to do grave nature because on the one hand you have, you know, the wacky fun, and on the other you have serious adult things. And I think if you have both, if you have the wacky on the one hand and the serious on the other, and you put them together, it's more money. And, you know, people like that. So my number 5 is a moment, one of the earliest moments that I can remember of a story really, really touching me. And it is the first story that I remember reading by a creator best known these days as the original author. But back in the day, he used his name, Alan Moore. And Alan Moore didn't write a whole lot of mainstream DC in the early days, but he did, you know, bits and pieces here. And one of those was Action Comics number 11, or annual rather, number 11, For the Man Who Has Everything.
Yeah.
And there are moments in that story that are very touching because basically Mongol shows up. He traps Superman in a dream world where everything he wants is real. He's on Krypton. He's living with his parents. He's married. He has children, he's happy, he has a life, he doesn't have to worry about everybody in the world. And halfway through the story, you know, Superman's mind starts seeing inconsistencies in the story. He doesn't,
cat
you know,
walks
see
by
how
twice.
Things work.
Yeah, the cat right, walks there, by twice, and
there
he
are
keeps
moments
calling
where,
his wife
you know,
Lois.
He realizes that it's dream logic. And he is sitting there with his beloved son, Vanzi, and he's starting to feel like something is wrong, and in tears, Kal-El turns and puts his hand on his boy's shoulder and says, Van, I don't think you're real. And he is heartbroken to realize this, that his beloved family isn't real. And, you know, this is Superman. This is a guy who has basically spent, at this point, decades or a decade alone after the death of his family. You know, his parents died, and then he went to a new world, and then his new parents died, and he had to go off to Metropolis by himself. And it's just, it's a heartbreaking story, but it's capped by one of the most shocking pre-crisis Superman moments, because after waking up from that dream, Superman stands up and Mongol is laughing and doing his villain montage. And Superman just says, burn, and starts just flat out heat visioning Mongol. And it's Batman and Wonder Woman who have to keep him from literally murdering Mongol on the spot. Mm-hmm. But it is such a touching moment just to see Superman, you know, Kal-El talking to his son there, and just, oh, made me cry.
Yeah.
I think I was maybe 14 when that book came out. It was like 1985.
Yeah, I've got a couple of Superman things on my list. We'll get to those in just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a good one. You know, The Man Who Has Everything almost made my list just because of that heartbreak of, you know, you got what you wanted and then having the realization that it's taken away from you is really heartbreaking.
Yes.
But my number four is actually Tears of Happiness, right? Mm. So one of my, there are two issues of Sandman that are my favorite. Mm-hmm. The first one is the, and it's not my number one, but one of the two is the one that is the Shakespeare one, where they do Midsummer's Night's Dream and all the Fae come and they watch this and, you know, Morpheus and William Shakespeare have had this agreement and, you know, it all ends well, that, you know, ends well happily and all those good things. But mm-hmm. my favorite issue of Sandman is Sandman number 13, which kind of introduces the concept of William Shakespeare and Morpheus meeting previously, mm-hmm. but more importantly, introduces the character of Hobgadling.
Oh.
And Hobgadling is this guy in the 1400s. I think it's 1400s, maybe before that. But you know, they're in this tavern and Morpheus comes in and Hob is just like, oh man, I hate the time period now. I want to live, you know, forever. It's up to a man to decide whether he's going to live or die. And I choose to live forever. And Morpheus is like, oh, is that right? My guess is that you're quickly going to tire of this and, you will decide to die. And Hobgadling's like, no way. Never.
Death's a mug's game.
Yeah. And so Morpheus says, okay, here's the deal. We will meet here in this tavern in 100 years. And Morpheus comes back 100 years later and there's Hob, and Hob's like, yeah, this is great. The Black Plague was a little bit of a downer, but you know, I'm still loving this. And Morpheus is like, okay, well, we'll come back another 100 years and have another drink. Comes back another 100 years and Hob has gone through some things. And then they keep doing this every 100 years. At one point, Hob is upset because he got into the slave trade and realized that it was a horrible thing for him to get into. And we go through until we get to 1880, and Morpheus is basically like, come on, I'm glad you're doing this, but you can't really still maintain this positive attitude that you want to live forever. And Hobgadling is like, no, I definitely do intend to live forever. In fact, I think you want me to live forever, and that's why you keep agreeing to come back every 100 years. And Morpheus is like, no. And then Hobgadling tells Morpheus, tell you what, you've always been saying you want to meet back here in 100 years. I'm going to say you are going to meet me back here in this tavern in 100 years, not because you want to check in with me, mm-hmm. but because we are friends.
Mm-hmm.
And Morpheus is like, how dare you? I have no friends. You think I want to be a friend with a mortal? And Morpheus storms off. And then 1980 rolls around, or whatever year this issue came out, 86 maybe. I forget the exact year of this release. But in the end, Morpheus is kind of late to their meeting, but he goes to the tavern anyway. And sure enough, Hobgadling is there. And he's like, oh, for a moment, I didn't think you were going to show up. And Morpheus is like, how could I let down a friend?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, wow, that is such a great way.
Such a sweet moment.
Yeah. And it's one of those that brings tears to your eyes. It's one of those, I'm happy, not because it's a sad moment, but because mm-hmm. it is this joyous moment between two people who have had a relationship for so long that they don't really need to be told. Each other doesn't have to go to the other and say, hey, I consider you my friend, but you know it. And the fact that Hob and Morpheus have to push each other to say it, especially in the 1980s, you know, as we start to change, you know, men aren't supposed to cry and men are manly men and they don't admit feelings for each other. Sandman number 13 says, yeah, it's okay to do those kinds of things. And it's just mm-hmm. so sweet and nice and wonderful that it had to go on my list. I just recently listened to the audio adaptation of this on Audible from Neil Gaiman, and it's great too. People should go check part one out. Part two is out now. But Sandman number 13, my number four of comics that make you cry.
That's a great one, because throughout the series, people say Morpheus, they tell him, Morpheus, you've changed. And his response is always the same. He always says, I doubt it.
Yeah.
But that issue is one of the obvious, you know, that's just proof that he changed. And ironically, and in no way fake, this is legit, my number four is also an issue of Sandman.
Oh, yeah. This one or a different one? Does it feature Hob Gadling?
It does not feature Hob Gadling, although my favorite Hob Gadling story is Hob's Leviathan, which is a story that doesn't have Morpheus in it at all.
Mm. I don't think I've read that one.
You have.
Because I usually stop right around the time that we end the Shakespeare stuff. So,
mine is actually in the volume after that, A Season of Mists.
Mm-hmm.
And it is issue 37. And throughout the Season of Mists, the story has been centered on a group of characters living in an apartment building. There's Barbie and her husband, Ken.
Yeah. Yep, I know them.
Yep. And then, of course, there's Hazel and Foxglove and Thessaly the Witch and a woman named Wanda.
Yep.
And throughout the story, you know, everybody's story comes to the front. And we discover at one point that Thessaly is going to use her magic to take the women to another world. And Thessaly's like, I'm sorry, Wanda, you can't go. Which is, you know, if I recall correctly, one of the first overt mentions that Wanda is a trans woman. But during the story, when they are dealing with things in the other world, Wanda is left in the real world. And Wanda ends up being killed by, you know, completely, well, not mundane, but a storm that was related to what's going on in the mystical lands.
Mm.
And so Wanda dies, and she ends up, she gets sent home to her family, who did not agree with her choices in life, and tried to bury her under her dead name. And so Barbie came to the Midwest, to Kansas. It's the issue that has the Kansas references that don't make sense if you live in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's driving east and she sees Salina before she sees Goodland. And I'm like, no, that's not how Kansas works. But nonetheless, she gets to Wanda's grave and finds that they have the wrong name on it. And she takes her lipstick and scrawls in big letters, Wanda, across the dead name on the grave, just so that people know who her friend really was. And it's such a sweet moment. And it's a moment in a story that's really dark, even by Sandman standards. I mean, we're not talking like 24 hours in a diner dark from issue 8.
Yeah.
But it's really dark, and there's a really heavy body count throughout it. And then, of course, it rolls right into a story with an even bigger body count. But, oh, man, I do love that moment. And I remember being just totally verklempt when I first read that. Not in the original issues. I never read Sandman in the original issues. I read them in the collected trade paperbacks. Because if you read it an issue at a time, you'll just be insane.
I think that'd be really rough. Again, I just, like I said, I recently, we went through Sandman, the part one in autumn. So I got to relive all the issues that I read, but you know, I still get all skeeved out about the serial killer convention, and certainly, the Corinthian always just bothers me. So when I get into that sections of the book in the first read through, I'm just like, you know, who is this, you know, and not really knowing who Neil Gaiman was at the time, who is this effed up person and why is he writing such horrible stories? And then you get past that. And then you get into like the Hob Gadling stuff and the stuff about the, what's her name? Is it Rose? Who is the storm?
Yep.
And it's like,
Rose,
oh yeah, these
her little brother, Jed.
Yeah. And these are like really cool stories. Unfortunately, you have to still deal with some of that horrific stuff. So that's why usually I get up to about the 26th, 25th issue, and I'm just like, okay, that's about as far as I can go. But I also read these in trades. Yeah, I read these in trades. And if I had read them in their single issues, I would have said, no way am I coming back for creepy eye mouth guy on the cover.
Yeah. The Corinthian is creepy, creepy, creepy. Don't ever read about the Corinthian, and for God's sake, don't dream about him.
It's unfortunate that you can't get away from him. I mean, certainly Corinthian-esque imagery has become a total meme online.
Yeah, people are jerks.
I mean, they're having fun, but it's certainly not something that makes me cry. It almost made me not get to issue 13 and everything after. So I also like, I mean, I don't have any more Sandman on my list, but I do, I did like the, what's the Metamorpho woman name?
Urania.
Urania
Blackwell,
right.
the elemental woman.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not on my list, but it almost made it. Remember Three Septembers into January, the mostly true story of Emperor Norton, the first and only emperor of the United States of America.
Oh, from San Francisco. No, if that's a Sandman story, I can't wait to get to that. Cause I've never, like I said, I've issue 25 and that's it. So
yeah, that's my brain says that's like issue 29, 30, something like that.
I've got the Absolute Edition, so I may have to dig that out. Yeah.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. Back into our sad crying moments. There are two different identity crisis instances on my top five list. And in hindsight, this one is probably more powerful and probably should be flipped around with the other one. Mm-hmm. But there is a moment where, and I forget who is stalking Tim Drake's father. I think it's Boomerang.
Captain Boomerang.
Yeah, Captain Boomerang. And Tim, of course, finds out about this, and he's trying to get to his father, and he's on the phone with Batman or the intercom or whatever that they're using, their walkie-talkies, and just begging Batman to rush as fast as he can to save his father. And it's a huge sequence, like multiple pages, to where we get to the part where, you know, Tim's on the phone with his dad and his dad saying everything's going to be okay and all these things. And he's pleading with Batman to hurry up and get there. Of course, Batman gets there too late, but Tim is already there as well. And he has to comfort Tim and hold him after his father has died. And I think that if you get through those panels without shedding a little tear, when you just see this horror, this look on Tim's eye, if I remember correctly, all we see is like his eyeball peeking out from the shadows created by Batman.
And he's looking straight at the reader.
Yeah, which is also a little disconcerting, right?
Spike the camera. Yeah, it frightened me because as much as you read that as, oh my God, he's crushed, I read that as, oh my God, he's slowly just sinking into the horror that is Batman's life.
Yeah, no, seriously, that's what it comes to. But, you know, just that moment of Tim trying to save his father and then not being able to save his father. And again, just like Batman and Robin 18, where we see the death of Damian Wayne, it is that death of someone that has meaning for you that just causes the character in the book to fall apart. And of course, hopefully the reader to fall apart as well. So my number three is the identity crisis moment where it is the death of Tim Drake's father.
Yep. We should do a list of top five Robin related deaths.
Oh man,
because
there's a lot of them.
The best part is we could literally do four people doing five different things and we still have.
There's the death of Stephanie Brown, who I just happened to be a Robin at the time. Oh man, you're right.
There's the death of his parents.
Tim Drake's parents dying in two different instances.
Two different
his mother dying, his mother dying from poisoned by some voodoo priest, and then his father dying from Captain Boomerang. So,
that's creepy.
Yeah. What do you have for number three, Matthew?
My number three is thematically awesome. Ask me why.
Why, Matthew?
It's from a comic called We Three.
Oh yeah. This one was I went around looking to see if anybody else had listed like comics that make you cry, and definitely We Three is high on this list.
Oh yeah, We Three is just so amazing. But the end of We Three comes to a point where our characters, who are cybernetically enhanced animals, a kitty, a puppy, and a bunny, have escaped and are running loose across the country in their little armored suits. And they're named 1, 2, and 3, but their real names are Bandit, Tinker, and Pirate. And they are trying, they were designed to kill humans, but they're trying to get away. Mm-hmm. And as they, you know, are being chased across the country, it comes to a point where Pirate, the bunny, sacrifices himself to save his friends. And they're talking, you know, and they talk in a very specific way.
Yeah. And somewhat robotic, like, at times.
Yeah. But they're talking not just robotic, because they're, you know, they're animals with a strange confluence of the universe. And, you know, the cat is like, man stink.
Right.
And the dog is like, our dog good. But we get to a point where he's about to kill himself, And he's, I can't even remember the phrase now. It just makes me cry. But he's like, home means no more run.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sacrifices himself so that his friends can get away. And it's just so heartbreaking. And then, of course, it ends. The last bit of the story, we find a strange homeless man with his dog and his cat, who look like they, you know, might be disabled dog and cat, or they might be dog and cat who've been pulled out of, you know, their cybernetic suits.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the man is just sitting there and he's talking about how the government is up to no good. And somebody's like, your animals are so well behaved. And I'm like, yeah,
Yeah, for people who want to hear our thoughts on this, you need to go all the way back to the Major Spoilers Podcast, episode 133 from 2009. That's when we reviewed We Three.
Oh, it's a good story.
Yeah,
good story.
That was a long time ago, too, man.
Are comics good? No, wait, that's a different show.
different show.
Different show.
Okay, so we have come up to our number two, and I mentioned Superman because really, to be quite honest, anytime Superman does something heroic, and I don't mean like lifting a car off of somebody or, you know, putting a dam back together as it's bursting, but Superman showing empathy and understanding anytime Superman is doing that kind of stuff makes me cry. So there are two moments that I'm going to combine in here just because it's Superman, and of course you can do anything you want because it's my show, and I'm combining two Superman moments. The first one is in Action Comics 775, where he's talking, I think this is the
first appearance of the Elite.
Yeah, the Elite, that's who it is. Where Superman says, dreams save us, dreams lift us up and transform us, and on my soul I swear, until my dream of a world where dignity, honor, and justice becomes the reality we all share, I'll never stop fighting, ever. If that doesn't make you tear up, what's wrong with you? Are you not a human? Are you not somebody that wants the world to be better? And that is a great Superman quote, okay? Then, of course, I'm thinking, who wrote the Elite?
Joe.
Oh, was it Joe? Oh, for some reason, I thought Grant Morrison was involved in their thing. Which brings me then to the second really great Superman moment in All-Star Superman, where there is a girl, I think it's a girl, is about to jump off the edge of a building. She's about to commit suicide. Yeah. She's about to commit suicide, and Superman just comes up and has a conversation with her and essentially says, we all have bad days. Even I have a bad day. And through the conversation, I think it's maybe two or three pages, maybe two pages. Heck, if it's only one page, it's great.
Yeah, I think it's just one page.
Really? Wow. Then it's even more powerful because I always remember it being like two pages. And Superman talks the jumper off the edge of the building. And it's just so, not somebody who's like, I'm just doing my job as a police officer. And I'm not saying that police officers who are talking people off the edge of a building aren't sincere in their conversations with people.
Right.
But when Superman does it, even though it's written, even though it's somebody else who's putting the words in Superman's mouth, even though Superman is a fictional character, it shows that somebody really gets Superman when you can write those words, and shows that it doesn't have to be, as you said a moment ago, Matthew, where Superman just wants to burn Mongol to death.
Yes.
But it shows that this is a person who understands what it means to suffer.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, this is the essence of Superman. I mean, there's maybe 30 words on that page.
Yeah.
But it's just perfect essence of Superman. You are so much stronger than you think. And I just, that's such a good moment. That is a good, I should have had that on my list. I'm mad at you for taking
You can certainly take it and say, that is also my number two, Stephen. Brilliant. You're a brilliant man. and great minds and all those things. Okay. But, you know, I don't recall
saying you are brilliant.
I mean, you could certainly say that. And then you could also share in this number two with me. We can share our number twos together.
Have you ever seen that meme of what would you tweet to let people know you've been kidnapped? My number two.
What's the thing from Manchurian Candidate? Matthew is the greatest, finest person I've ever met.
Kindest, warmest, most personable human I have ever met. Yeah.
Yeah. What is your number two that makes everybody
mine
cry?
Mine is much earlier than yours because I grew up in the Bronze Age of comics, the 1980s. It was a time when seagulls came in flocks and balloons in groups of 99. And comic books were written by Roger Stern. Stern and John Romita Jr. started doing Spider-Man together literally the month that I started reading Spider-Man as a 14-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. So I started at the very beginning, but about 10 or 12 issues in, we get an issue where the story is a fight with Thunderball, but then there's a backup. Amazing Spider-Man number 248, the backup story is called The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. Now, here's the thing. This is a story that is beloved by readers, beloved by creators. Wizard Magazine, whom I seldom quote and don't necessarily always respect the opinions of, named this one of the best Spider-Man stories ever. And it is my favorite Spider-Man story because The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man is a story about a kid who just, he loves Spider-Man. He's the biggest Spider-Man fan in the world. And the framing sequence is a column by, I think, Phil Urich, but it's a column in the Daily Bugle talking about this Spider-Man fan and how he loves Spider-Man and he wishes he could meet Spider-Man. And during the story, Peter Parker climbs in his window in full costume. And he's like, hey, I'm Spider-Man. And they talk about his stories. And the kid's like, what about Dr. Octopus? And, you know, Spider-Man is having this wonderful time. This kid loves him, wants to know all about him. He's having fun with this little boy. And the kid's like, who are you really? And Spider-Man takes off his mask and says, my name is Peter. And I do this because when I was younger, there was an accident and my Uncle Ben died. And I feel a responsibility to keep that from happening to other people. And the kid is so touched by this. And at the end of the story, you know, Spider-Man cries. He's climbing out the window crying. And I'm crying. And then we see the last line of the story. Tim has fatal leukemia and is not going to survive.
Yeah.
And Tim passes away at the end of the story. The doctors only gave him a few weeks to live. And it's this wonderful moment where you kind of see, like that Superman moment, straight to the heart of Spider-Man. When it comes down to it, Spider-Man is just a really smart kid who got thrown into a situation where he feels like he has to do these things out of responsibility. But it's just a sweet moment for Spidey. It's a moment where we get to see an excited kid treating him like a hero, where most of the time, you know, Spider-Man gets villainated.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get to the end of that story and it's just so, so crushing. And, you know, when I was 14, it was the 80s. And, you know, we were still in the men don't cry phase. You know, you were allowed to wear a pink suit and no socks like Don Johnson. But man, this story just teared me up something fierce. And you should read it. It honestly,
I think I have
best. You definitely have because we've read it in a collection.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the regal you. Listening to the
all
major
y'all.
Spoilers top five right now. All yeah, all y'all. Y'all is singular.
I'm
all
going to bet. I'm going to bet that. I'm going to take a bet that more than half the people who are listening to this episode right now have also read that issue. That's going to be my guess. We have a very smart, well-rounded. We've got a smart, well-rounded audience. Who's into these kinds of things and probably go out of their way to read some of these stories. And so I'm sure we have a great audience. You know who else is great?
Who dat?
This awkward transition into our Patreon plug at patreon.com/majorspoilers. All of our patrons are wonderful. They help make this show possible. And when you become a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers, like Jimmy has, you've kind of got a direct line to us. So, you know, if we're in an exclusive Patreon chat channel on our Discord server and Jimmy right. comes up and says, excuse me, you guys, could you please review, do a top five comics of Major Cry? Man, that's going to have a lot more weight to it than somebody who just shouts out of the out from the darkness from the back row screaming, I got in for free and I want you guys to do one on your top five favorite boogers.
Why does Jimmy talk like Oliver Twist in your mind again?
Because Jimmy is a kind
Please,
soul.
Sir, may I have some more top five?
He is a good, kind soul, just like our poor little boy from A Christmas Carol, who in the sequel to A Christmas Carol grows up to be a horrible, horrible person.
I think you're thinking of Tiny Tim.
Yes, that's who also I am thinking of.
Tiny Tim.
But hey, we would love for you, dear listener, if you are not already one of our patrons, to take a jump over to patreon.com/majorspoilers and share in all of the excitement and joy and get access to like our exclusive Discord channels on our Discord server, where you can interact with us from time to time and join in some of our live shows that we do on our Discord channel. But you can only do that when you become a patron at the silver level and higher. So what are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers, support us today, and allow us to continue to do more top fives in the near future. I don't think a lot of people realize that, Matthew. All of our funding for everything that we do at Major Spoilers, and it's not a lot. I mean, we're not bringing in $9 million a year off the work we do. I'd be surprised if we even hit six figures in a year off of the work that we do.
Yeah.
But it's all funded and made possible through the support of the work of our patrons. And if you want to know something that makes me cry,
what's that?
It is the generosity of all the people who are patrons. I feel like the Grinch, where my heart swells three sizes and it bursts out of my chest because my heart should not be three sizes too big, but just brings a tear to my eye.
That's called cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, I think that's what
it is. It's actually a very serious disorder.
But that's what happens when I think about all of our fine patrons, is they just fill me with such joy and happiness that it just brings a tear to my eye. So thank you, patrons, for giving me a swelled heart. I now must go see my doctor, apparently.
Yeah, you're probably going to be on blood thinners.
Yeah, and now back to our regularly scheduled podcast.
And hydrochlorothiazide.
No, probably not. My number one, again, I had mentioned Identity Crisis appeared twice on this. Mm-hmm. And in that first issue, they really spend a lot of time setting you up for sadness. In that you get to see, and for those people that know who Ralph and Sue Dibny are, the elongated man and his wife, Sue, you know that they share a very special connection with one another. And you know that theirs is a love that was meant to be from the very first time that they laid eyes upon one another back in the 1950s. They were a couple that was match made in heaven. And they have gone on wondrous adventures together, and they are just the perfect couple that you wish you and your loved one were. And then she dies horribly. Burned to death. And again, Ralph is rushing to make sure that she is safe, and she is not. And unfortunately, that final page where the sprinkler system is going off and Ralph literally can't hold himself together because of the grief over his dead wife in his arms is just, at the time, to me, just, I'm bawling. You know, even before you get to that final reveal, I'm just bawling over the fact that how could they do this? How could these horrible people kill off this beloved character in the form of Sue Dibny? And I feel so much pain and sorrow for Ralph and the grief that he must be going through. And I sure do hope over these next 11 issues that we find out who done it. And that's what kicks off the Identity Crisis series over at DC. Unfortunately, I mean, at the time, when I was reading this, man, I'm just sitting there on the couch, just crying, and my wife's looking at me like, what in the heck? And it's like, oh, I don't ever want to lose you the way that Sue Dibny went out. And then she's like, I don't think anyone's going to take a flamethrower to me and stomp on my brain. That's a clue, by the way.
Oh, she says that. But
yeah, that's what my wife says, but I think she knows the truth. But yet the time, I'm just crying. Today, I think it feels a little ham-fisted, and it's kind of problematic. In places.
The development of the mystery is not up to that cliffhanger open. And mm-hmm. I agree with you. The visual of Ralph literally melting while he holds her under the sprinklers.
He just can't keep it together. Yeah.
Just masterful. But, you know, from there on.
I forget who was the artist on that.
Rags Morales.
Rags Morales just does some fantastic art. And
Rags is amazing.
Yeah. And throughout the series, I think he does a really, really good job in that. So my number one, the death of Sue Dibney in Identity Crisis. Now, Matthew, your number one, I'm sure, is the resurrection of Hal Jordan.
I will find you. I mean, that's not a terrible story.
It's not. I mean, it really, I mean, who's that? That's everybody's favorite guy.
The entire creative team is on my list of people I don't trust anymore. But yeah, you know, at the time, you know, not bad. But no, my number one is a story by a creative team that I trust implicitly. They have proven time after time, year after year, issue after issue, that they can do touching, they can do horrifying, they can do creepy, they can do funny, they can do wild and crazy, and they can do the most touching comic in the history of comics. And I don't say that necessarily with a great deal of yatata or a great deal of, you know, over amping it. I honestly feel that this is a perfect comic book. Astro City, number one half, which was originally a mail-away comic, a Wizard promo book. It was later finally, thankfully, collected, reprinted in, you know, in an issue that you could just go out and buy. And of course, it's part of the Astro City collections, which I think are now going to be at
Image.
Where are they now? They're at Image?
Yeah, okay. I believe it's Image.
They had just recently been at Vertigo, and then Vertigo kind of collapsed. But the thing about Astro City number one half is how wonderfully perfect it is. Because Astro City is not about the superheroes. Astro City is about a world full of people in a universe where superheroes exist. And so the story opens with a man named Michael who keeps having these recurring dreams, just these recurring dreams of a woman that he loves. He loves more than anything. And he can't quite get over it. He can't figure it out. And it's this really strange existential thing where he knows this woman. He knows this woman, but she doesn't exist. You go home, you go to sleep, you dream of Miranda. You get up, you go around your life. Miranda does not exist. But you're completely in love with this dream. And one night, he's sitting in his bed, and the Hanged Man, who is a mystical being, comes through the ceiling and tells him, okay, here's the deal. She did exist. He doesn't talk like that. The Hangman talks all, you know, schmoopy.
She doesn't exist. I'm the Hanged Man.
You fear you are going mad, but you are not. Your dreams were in truth reality. And he shows her the truth that, shows Michael the truth that Miranda did exist, but the universe was destroyed, or nearly destroyed, and the heroes of Astro City rebuilt reality, kind of like the Zero Hour story that came a few years later. But they rebuilt reality, and a few inconsistencies slipped through, and one of them was that Miranda never existed. But he still knew her, and he loved her, and he was married to her. And the Hanged Man tells him that as part of this, he is traveling around and offering everyone the chance to forget. And Michael and Miranda, you know, it's a part of him. It's in his DNA. He cannot sleep without knowing, but he thinks for a moment and he tells the Hanged Man, no, I don't want to forget. And if that's not heartbreaking enough, he then goes, wait, how many people choose to forget? And the Hanged Man just sort of floats there, and you can almost see him smile under his burlap hood. And he says, no one forgets. No one. And oh, such a moment. And the story ends with Michael finally going back to sleep and the Hangman floating out into the world. But it is so wonderful. It is so perfect. And my description of it doesn't do it any favors. And if you haven't read it, I'm so sorry. I just spoiled it for you. But if you have, you're in tears right now. You're sniffling a little bit. And the reason why is this is an amazing story. And every time I read it, every time I think about it, I did a retro review of it several years ago at majorspoilers.com. It's about 10 years ago, actually. Look around 2011. It was a Sunday in 2011.
There you go.
You'll find it. It'll be there. And,
so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Five comics that made us realize that there's dust or something in the air and we should probably go clean the house or change the filter on our air conditioner or furnace system, or perhaps that you realize you're suddenly allergic to something, cat dandruff, whatever it may be. I'm definitely not crying. You're not crying. And the reason why we're not crying is because what we're really looking forward to is going over to the Major Spoilers Discord server in the Top 5 channel. This is free. You don't have to be a patron for that. You can go over there, and everybody will be talking about the top 5 comics that made them cry. They will say, here's my list. Here's the reason why. Some people just put in a short list. Some people go on and have lengthy conversations about licorice, Matthew. but the nice thing is everybody's super polite over in our Discord server. Everybody's going to read your list. They're going to read everyone else's list. They're going to share their lists of the top 5 comics that made you cry. Why? Because everyone loves a list, and we will talk with you soon.
This podcast is copyright 2021 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.